this is Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I'm so glad that you're with me on this very fine Friday night. I hope that you have a chance to step outside and see the lunar eclipse and maybe catch a brief look at the comet that's supposed to be coming through also. It is the snow moon, which is a new moon. Tonight I'm speaking with one of my all-time favorite fiction novelists, Richard North Patterson, but he's written something very different and very unusual and very interesting, and you're going to hear all about it in just a second, so hang in there and don't go away. My guest tonight is Richard North Patterson. Mr. Rick Patterson, that would be, wrote a series of columns for the Huffington Post during the presidential race in the fall of 2015. He wrote a weekly column chronicling what was happening in politics and how amused and appalled he was. And I thought it was so funny that he wrote such an interesting book. That book is called Swamp Fever, A Journey Through the Strange Neverland of the 2016 Presidential Race. I am so honored, besides all the so many glorious fiction books that he's written, but I'm so honored that Richard North Patterson is with me tonight on Authors in the Air. Richard North Patterson, welcome. Thank you so much for being my guest tonight. Hi, Rick. How are you?
I'm great.
I am I'm thrilled that you're here. I'm thrilled that you're here because I get to ask you about all your really cool books, besides Swamp Fever, which was one of the funniest books I think I've ever read. The satire is beautiful. Who knew you could write satire like that? Did you?
Well, I really didn't. I mean, you know, the invitation to write for the Huffington Post from 2015 through the election of 2016 was merely a coincidence. I thought I was retired from writing. But I finally found a story and a character, actually more than one, but a particular character I couldn't make up, Donald Trump. And good fiction needs characters, and it needs a story. you know, and there was no better story than Campaign in 2016, which has, I mean, it was awful, it was ghastly, it was funny, it was unpredictable, and filled with compelling characters of all sorts, and it has immense consequence. We are electing, as Americans, the most powerful person in the world. And this lead character, Donald Trump, was unique in our political history. So the story of Donald Trump, to me, was not only the story of his beliefs, but his personal psychology, like who he is, why we respond to him as we did. I mean, Richard Nixon showed how important personality was to the White House and how dangerous it could be if it goes askew. But Donald Trump is infinitely more unpredictable than Nixon. So to me, it was an irresistible opportunity to write about stuff which is, as you point out, sometimes funny, but ultimately, you know, scary. He's now our president.
I think that, you know, from everything I read in social media, and I do read it, and I do try to stay away from a lot of mainstream press. I think that people take what they read as fact all the time, and it is not necessarily true. So I think there's an old adage, you believe half of what, nothing of what you hear and half of what you see. So I kind of have always lived by that rule, and even though I enjoy politics very much and I'd like to be involved, when you're on social media, it's a different animal completely. Now, I know that you don't go on social media. You're, you know, you're way smarter than most of us are.
Well,
take a break from it.
You know, every once in a while I get surprised by how dumb I am, but I shouldn't be.
You fall to its mercies. But it certainly has. I'm not a youngster, by the way. You know, I have voted in every single election that there ever was, for even if it was for dog catcher. I've never missed my opportunity to vote because I thought that it was a beautiful privilege given to me that I had to earn, and I had to earn it by voting every single time. So politics has always been very fascinating to me, although because it's so divisive, and I can't put my finger on where that started. Because it wasn't just this year or last year or the year before. I think it's something that's been coming along. And I don't know why, and I don't know how it happened. I can't put my finger on it. Maybe that's something you can talk it to. But I have to say that I'm not necessarily very happy with the outcome. I'm nervous about it, but I don't know what to expect. And I'm thankful that our country so far has been resilient, and I don't know if that's naive or not, Rick. What do you think?
Well, you know, you know, Pam, you really brought up so many things in the course of expressing what your confusion is, which many people are confused about. God knows, what does this mean for us?
Mm-hmm.
Why did it happen? I mean, first of all, why are we divided? We have a Democratic Party which is coastal, in a Republican Party,
yes,
which occupies large swaths of the South and Midwest and in rural states. And those people no longer know each other. It's not only a matter of demographics, a matter of sorting by population, where people more and more move where like-minded people are. It's a matter of culture and religion. It's a matter of different sources of information, what people choose to believe. So we essentially have two Americas who don't know each other. We have islands of blue, Democrats, and a sea of red, and they not only don't know each other, they don't like each other, they don't trust each other. And so the immense division, and let me give you an example. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by 3 million, that's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So why didn't she win? Well, because the Electoral College sorts things in different ways. So, for example, 70,000 people voting in three states, Pennsylvania, in Michigan, Wisconsin, winning election with Donald Trump. But more than that, we had 50% of people voting for Republicans, 50% of people voting for Democrats in congressional elections. Republicans took 55% of the votes. That's demographic sorting, which is to say, you know, polarization and where we choose to live has divided America into two camps. So we don't know each other anymore. And that's a huge thing.
How did that happen, though, Rick? How did it be? Who started this? Because I want to blame Congress for everything. I really do. I want to blame them. I want to blame some of the media. I want to blame a lot of people but us, and I know that isn't fair. I want to say, well, somebody kind of pitted this one against the other, but who is somebody?
Well,
I think we
did it ourselves, but also the parties found that, you know, that their base was more important than the middle. So most Republican Congress people, for example, are worried about losing to somebody who's more to the right than they are. They don't care about the middle because their congressional districts are carved out so that people who are voters can't make decisions between Republicans and Democrats. It's a one-party system in those districts, for, you know. So, I mean, that's
sure,
really a problem. But also, we don't have a common experience anymore. We don't have the draft. We don't
right.
have ways in which people with different life circumstances meet each other. And so what happens is more and more Americans see their opposite numbers politically is not just people disagree, but enemies. And so that's
mm-hmm.
a terrible thing. We're angry at each other, and we don't know what to do.
I never thought about it like that. You said, you're right, we don't have a common experience. We briefly did after September 11. We
mm-hmm.
briefly do after these catastrophic things that happen. but it's not enough to hold on to. It kind of is reminiscent to me of living in South Florida all my life, where we've had hurricanes, and you know, you've houses have blown over, and you've lost power and water and everything else, and so neighborhoods gathered up to take care of each other, but it never lasts, and that's why, you know, I was nervous about the Women's March in Washington, although so honored and so proud, and the global marches in kind. You know, I thought it was wonderful, but then I thought, gosh, I really hope that that doesn't fade from the collective consciousness, which, you know, you would think that was a powerful thing to draw a lot of people together. But it's, I don't know, what's next? That's what I want to know. What's next?
Wait a minute.
Why
Indian,
don't
that's
we
problem.
Have, yeah, why don't we have
what's
a collective
how do we,
experience?
How do we elect a reality TV star who had no government experience as our president? We do lack a common understanding of facts or truth for things as simple as climate change, and it's profound. Americans of different backgrounds, as I said, don't trust or even know each other. Americans sort of live in gated communities of the mind where they're walled off by partisan media and social media, detached from fact or reason very often. Millions of people believe our institutions are corrupt, our established media are liars, our politicians are self-serving hacks, the government's our enemy, and all we can do is blow it up. And Donald Trump, who I think has some serious issues as a human being, had a genius. I mean, he could use the anger and frustration to get attention and fulfill his personal needs. And so now we have this thing where, Trump is not original. Our political polarization wiped out our sense of common citizenship. Millions of blue-collar workers feel displaced. In that environment, the need for a messenger met Trump's need to play the superhero with magical solutions. I mean, he's not, in fact, going to restore the coal industry. He can't reverse automation, which provides people of jobs.
Right, manufacturing and all.
Making people secure. So the fascinating to me was it was like the world's best drama because all these social conditions come together. Then there are all these human beings interacting. I mean, Flock, I mean, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, all the people in the GOP tried to beat Donald Trump. I mean, it was this drama with enormous stakes. It was really fascinating to write about.
I would imagine. Were you as dismissive of the candidate as the rest of his fellow candidates were in the beginning?
I thought Americans would get tired. I really did. I thought he brags all the time. Nobody likes that. He's like the guy in a bar room who knows it all, and after a couple of drinks, he knows more. He has obvious self-involvement. Everything comes back to him. I thought, who would want this guy for a friend? Who would want this guy on their television? But what I underrated was how desperate people were, how despairing people felt, how divided people felt. I just missed, like a lot of people missed, that this guy kind of met his moment. I mean, look, I mean, the guy was accused of sexual harassment. That would kill a normal candidate. The guy bragged about groping women. That would kill a normal candidate. He told obvious lies. That would kill a normal candidate. Nothing touched him. Why? Because there was an underlying social anger. It was just sort of fascinating to write about. I was one of the first people who wrote that I thought this guy was emotionally disturbed. And I really do think so. I mean, I'm sad to say because he's our president. We have to place our hopes in the presidency. But I really worry that the drama I wrote about, there are constant twists and turns, when it comes to the drama we're living, because reality TV has now become our reality and the world's reality. And that's a fascinating, awesome, scary thing to watch.
Yeah, I know people are saying, he's not going to last long, and he's going to get tired of it, and he's going to quit, and, you know, someone else is going to take over. He's going to be impeached and all. And I'm thinking they're concerned about Twitter and all, and I think to myself, it's smoke and mirrors. Don't pay attention to that stuff. You know, it's like the magician who makes you focus on one hand and you don't look at the other, what the other hand is doing. So, and I think a lot of politicians are like that to a lesser or greater extent. And he has become a politician, let's face it. Whether you like him or not, he is a politician now. So, but the thing that is troubling to me, Rick, and maybe you'll have some thoughts on this too that you can enlighten me on. The thing that you mentioned, you know, anybody else with a history of sexual harassment or groping women or doing this, doing that, would never stay as a candidate. Well, now we have he's elected, he's running the country, and he doesn't care that he has business conflicts. The emoluments went out the window. That was gone the first day. Nobody talks about those things. He wants to be friends with Putin. I understand that we have to be friendly in order not to, you know, push nuclear buttons. That makes sense to me. But, you know, there are a lot of things that scare me and that are above my pay grade. I don't understand. Would you care to comment on that, please?
Well, I don't understand either half the time. But I think part of what was going on is because we have a deep need for a Superman to resolve our own deep confusion about where we're going and sense of our direction as Americans. We've elected somebody who has a complete inability to separate the world from his own psychodrama. He clearly has an inflated sense of his own superiority, a craving for admiration and flattery, a pretty deep indifference to truth. I mean, politicians lie, but he lies a lot. Unreasoning anger or criticism. I mean, he's taken on Nordstrom, for God's sakes. A lack of empathy. And a belief he has nothing to learn. That's the only, you know, rational explanation for his rejection, for example, of the intelligence finding about Russian hackers. I mean, the bottom line is that his relationship to reality is transitory and subjective and driven by what he needs to feel in the moment. So, I mean, he slanders people who he feels are critics. He praises people who like him. I mean, here's the thing.
Yeah.
Who claims to have a relationship with a man he's never met, Vladimir Putin? He claimed to know Putin back in 2015. He never met him. It's okay for a six-year-old to have imaginary friends. It's not okay if you're 70 and your friend is a murderous autocrat and you made him up. Who brags about assaulting women and then says he made it all up to look good? I mean, which he basically said about that Access Hollywood tape. Who calls for reporters pretending to be his own PR guy, which he did, so he can brag about his romantic conquests? I mean, he did in the 90s. He did in the 90s with People Magazine, their tapes. I mean, what is so disturbing to me is that this guy is, I mean, I'll just say he's pathological. I know I'm making lots of your listeners angry, and I'm sorry. I wish it weren't so. I love this country. I want our president to succeed. But this is a deeply disturbing human being. And because we have hopes that for the country, many people put their hopes in him. I understand it. We haven't noticed the obvious signs that this is a very troubled guy.
You said something earlier that kind of struck with me, and it looks to a larger thing. You said, you know, as we're very separate, our communities, whether you're East Coast, West Coast, whether you're in Middle America and all that. And I think that it's true that we've become more insular, that we're more, this is don't touch my stuff, this is mine, I earned it, leave me alone. Type of a thing. And I wonder if that also, if the thoughts of globalization, you know, if when we talk about globalization, I feel like Brexit was a warning that maybe globalization was happening too fast for lay people to absorb, and xenophobia, which has been going on in Germany for years and years and years, and yet there they are taking in the largest amount of refugees ever. But do you think that those things are all tied in to the fierce insularization, the insular feeling that individuals have it, even not even only in America, but other places too.
Oh, sure. I think there's a lot of fear, letting it out of their grip.
I'm sorry to say
that. There's a lot of fear in the world, also a lot of alienation. I'll give you an example or two. If you look at counties which voted for Trump, which are about 84% of American counties, and counties who voted for Clinton, which are about 16%, but the much more populous are very different. In Trump counties, in Clinton counties, the average median value of a house is 60% more than in Trump counties. Okay, that's a serious thing. Right there, in Trump counties, the rates of death by suicide and drugs and alcohol are higher than in Clinton counties. So we have a despair gap, basically.
Yes, we do. I'm not stunned by those. I'm not stunned by what you're saying, Rick, interestingly enough, because all of a sudden the marginalized become me or you. They become what we consider every average American. They feel marginalized. So I understand that. Do you think that the Democrats had the best possible candidate they could have had? Did they lose because of their own hubris?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, most Americans instinctively reject the word socialism. Bernie Sanders was a self-declared democratic socialist. I'm not sure that he would have done better than Hillary Clinton. He might have done worse. The real problem goes deeper than Clinton versus Sanders. I mean, the real problem is the thing we've been talking about, that Americans live two different realities. If you look at demographic breakdown, I wrote about this. I mean, most Republicans have Republican friends. 94% of Republicans are to the right of Democrats. 9% of Democrats are right of Republicans. They don't talk to each other. Most people report that most of their friends share their political beliefs. And not surprising, because they choose to live in different areas of the country. And that's a real issue. So, what did Trump promise people? He promised people that he would bring back their jobs by launching tariff wars and dumping free trade, that he would protect Social Security, that he would build up the infrastructure, he would beef up the military, he would give the middle class tax cuts. A lot of that, actually, Paul Ryan and folks like that don't like. So let me take it back to the level of fiction with great characters. You got Donald Trump, who, an inexperienced guy who's now president of the United States and wants to do great things, is a very complicated human being. You have the whole drama of his family. It's sort of like watching Dallas or a more modern soap opera, reality TV, where these rivalries and complex things. I mean, the Trump family is a human drama in itself. Then you have the Trump family versus the Clinton family, which I wrote about, another drama. Then you have Trump versus Paul Ryan. Ryan thinks he could control Trump. Trump thinks no one could control him. That thing's going to be acted out. You have all the fighting between men and women within families about who they chose. I mean, this thing, if I dare to make it up, was great fiction. And what I tried to do in Fever Swamp is give a narrative of how it was all playing out day to day. And every week there was something fascinating and unpredictable. And what I did in the book is I picked what I hope is the best of my columns, but I wrote essays after the fact to pull them together, and I did annotations about where I was right or wrong, and what else I had learned about stuff. I mean, it's fascinating. I talked to people on the inside of both campaigns about the effect of James Comey's letter the last 10 days. It wasn't the Huffington Post, but it said my book, and that changed the whole dynamic. Hillary Clinton went from a vibrant, upbeat candidate who'd wiped out Trump in three debates, and somebody who's on the defensive. And the whole dynamic of the campaign changed the last 10 days. I mean, the difference between writing fiction, as I did, and writing these things, I didn't know I was going to end. I just longed for the ride. trying to make sense of it. I mean, I tried to make that experience fascinating for the readers as it was for me. Because, you know, writing Fever Swamp was, at once horrifying and the best time I ever had, really, as a writer. It was great.
That's funny. I would imagine. You couldn't make up the story, could you?
No, you really couldn't.
You really couldn't. I mean, maybe you could, but not really.
Not sure I want
something,
to.
Rick. What? Yeah, right. What did you find the most surprising of everything besides the victory?
What I found surprising was the bond that Trump had with so many Americans. And it convinced me that we really don't understand each other. And that was what was so fascinating. So, I mean, the question is, how do we communicate with each other when the people's views of Trump are so different?
Yeah.
I mean, I know lots of people don't know a single person voted for Trump. I'm sure that people in America don't know a single person voted for Clinton. How do we get that way? And what do we do now? Let's suppose this administration falls apart. How do we find a solution to it? How does America come back together? I mean, Americans are compassionate people. They're kind people. We have a history. We have lots of terrible stains, whether it's slavery or Japanese internment or other social sins. But we've always tried to surmount them. We've always ended up deciding on a generosity of spirit. How do we get that back?
Questions that I ask myself these things all the time. Will, at the end of whatever this presidency is, whenever it is, 4 years, 8 years, I don't know, what happens next? Is it, I don't want to feel anxious. I don't want to have anxiety about interacting with people that I am just meeting. I don't want to... you know, I don't want to be suspicious of people. I want to wind back a little bit and go when I was younger. But it seems like the past maybe 10, 15, 20 years, it's maybe the past 15 years, I suppose, it's really become harder to understand all the division. I think I really saw it truthfully during Obama's administration. And just the outrage at him being elected. And now it's on the reverse side. Now there is another whole half of the country that's outraged because of Trump being elected. So, you know, is there someone who can bring us together, do you think?
I think the parties are now more and more trying to turn out their base rather than reach each other. Democrats' challenge, which they have to do, is become a national party again and talk to more people, regardless of where they live and who they are.
Yes.
And that's a very hard task, but they need to rebuild that way. If they don't, we're all in real trouble. I mean, demographically, we're becoming less white. The older, whiter people are, frankly, dying off. I mean, like, include me in that. We have a larger minority population. We have a young population. We have an increasingly educated population. So that all favors the Democrats who look at, you know, who votes for whom. Again, we are so divided. Somebody has to find a way to talk to somebody who's pro-life, talk to somebody who's pro-choice, and say, talk to somebody who's black, talk to somebody who's white, and say, but we're still a country. And we're a country that's going to thrive only if we make it a more comfortable, sharing, generous place for more people. That means taking care of our disadvantaged. I mean, struggling middle-class people, whether they're white or black, struggling working-class people, whether white or black, we have those things in common.
Yeah.
We're all mortal. We all care about our families. We all feel vulnerable. We all worry about our retirements. And we all want our kids to do better than we have, every one of us. So what does that mean? Somebody has to find a way to talk to them.
To say that again, I agree with you. I want to ask you, because you know, when you talked about the income disparities, it's really fascinating to me, because typically when we think of Republicans, we think of this very wealthy group of people, Democrats not quite as much. But in this past race, did the Democrats become the elitists? Because
I think they're viewed that way.
Yeah.
I think they're viewed that way.
I'm wondering.
I think lots of Republicans see Democrats
as
the elitist, arrogant people on the coast who look down on them. And that's a terrible problem Democrats have to address. I mean, when Hillary Clinton, who I think is a very capable person, spoke of the basket of deplorables, that was a real problem. Just as when Obama spoke about people claiming their guns and religion, that's a real problem. Now, there's some truth in what Obama said, because the Republicans have prospered by appealing to evangelicals and gun owners. But there's a way of saying that, okay? And there's a way of being condescending. I think more and more Democrats are viewed as being condescending. I mean, the media has a terrible problem. I happen to think the New York Times is liberal on the editorial page. Wall Street Journal is conservative. But they both have very good reporters who are doing an honest job of reporting things very well. But people no longer believe them. And Trump simply says anybody who identifies him as a liar, which he is quite often, is lying. And since there's a cultural division, people say, oh, well, the New York Times said something, it can't be true. They're picking on Donald. So he's created a terrible problem, because there's no commonly understood sense of fact anymore.
What happens to people who become brainwashed by that? Because that's what it feels like to me. I mean, I have friends on both sides of the aisle who don't believe anything at all, anything they say. Either they implicitly believe everything they read, or they deny every single thing they read. It's fascinating to me. So do people get caught up in this massive brainwashing almost? Does the country,
fall victim
to that, Rick?
I think so. I mean, I know people who make up stuff to make themselves feel better. I mean, I know a guy who's a Republican who doesn't like Trump. So he claims that Trump's candidacy was a Democrat conspiracy thrust on the Republican Party, who really didn't want Trump at all. Now, it's nonsense. It's complete nonsense.
The Republican candidates early on, their dismissal of Trump pushed him forward because he was so in their face. For example, you know, Marco Rubio, who hails from my state, Trump dismissed him summarily and insulted him and said, pay no attention to little Marco. Do you think that his fellow Republican candidates did not rebuke his behavior and the things he said, simply because they didn't want to be the butt of his tweets and conversation, and they thought he would just go away?
Well, you know, that's a whole one quarter of my book, and it's fascinating to watch how everybody, I mean, there was little Marco. And there was Ted Cruz who thought that Trump was going to fall apart, so he sucked up to him until it was too late. There was Jeb Bush, who had the curse of being considered the establishment candidate, and on and on and on, and Ben Carson. It was fascinating. What they all thought was that I'll be the last man standing, and you fall apart. And it didn't happen that way. They shot each other, and then Trump was a colossus. The only guy who had a prayer being was Cruz, and Cruz isn't going to beat him. Because Cruz basically was a Southern evangelical candidate. And, you know, the interesting thing about Trump is he was just flexible enough. Lots of people visited their hopes on him where they wouldn't have loved Cruz. So I thought, I wrote, and you've seen in the book, in late December I wrote, it's only going to be Trump unless it's Cruz. None of these guys are going to win. You know, in a Republican establishment, another thing, this is like the people, you know, people think they're dad, and then they realize the kids hate them. what happened is the Republican base started hating Republican establishment. They thought they could control Trump. They couldn't. I mean, it was just absolutely fascinating to watch the whole party structure of people who thought they ran things just fall apart. I mean, it's like a
great drama.
It was a great story. Yeah. It was great to write about.
Yeah. You know, I remember when Marco Rubio lost Florida, and right after that he dropped out of the race, but he gave a very impassioned speech on CNBC, I believe it was. And I watched, since I don't have a TV, I watched online. And he talked about how he felt about Donald Trump. And I think it was the first time I listened to Marco actually be presidential sounding. And I know him from a long time back because I grew up in Miami and all. And when he was a real up-and-coming guy in the Republican Party before he took a swing far to the right with the Tea Party. And I thought his speech was amazing. He said, we can't ban Muslims because they are the people that we're working with in the Middle East. These are people who are putting their life on the line for our soldiers. We can't do this to women. You know, we can't treat women this way because they are the backbone of our economy. And he was really, really great. He was really great, and I thought, why doesn't anyone call him on his crap during all the debates? And no one did. I just didn't understand that. I didn't understand, and I thought, my God, now see what you've got, you know? And so it goes. I mean, the rest is history, obviously.
Well, you know, Rubio waited until too late. He gave a good speech the other day. Why has stability been lost? I mean, how do we come together as a country where we're so busy verbally hating each other? And I think what Rubio is now thinking, and it's always easy to think he's calculating, but he's thinking is that Trump will last forever, and somebody's going to have to pick up the pieces. And I'm thinking he thinks it's him. But what, regardless of his motives, he said a couple of good things. And, you know, I just hope that's the spirit in which we can proceed. I mean, I think it's going to be an ugly time before we get there. I hope we do. Hope this is a wake-up call and not a turning point.
Yeah, I hear you. Do you mind if I ask you about some of your fiction now?
Sure.
And we'll come back to Fever Swamp. I have to tell you that when I started doing my research about you, Rick, before when I knew that you were going to come on the show, I was always just, I mean, I have a ton of your books. You know, I have the hardcover books because you're welcome. Thank you so much for writing such beautiful work. The one thing that strikes me about all of your books is probably the way you've lived your own professional life, in that there is a certain degree of social justice discussed and talked about and played out in every one of your books. And that very much appeals to me as someone who is a great believer in social justice. And many of the issues that you touch on are very personal to me. You and I had a very interesting conversation before we started this, this show live. And so, as you know, my hot button issue is advocacy for women who are domestic violence victims. Always has been for 25 years. I noticed that in your bio that you work with Family Prevention, the Family Violence Prevention Center, the fund. It's a wonderful. You also work with the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. There are a lot of things that you do, and those things are in your books. It had to be intentional on your part so that you're telling a wonderful story, but you're also hoping to give a message to your readers?
Yeah, I mean, I love stories. And, in the books I read and enjoy, don't need to have a message, but these things are important to me. I think it's really possible to tell a great story and have the context for it being something which is really important in the lives of human beings in their country. I mean, I wrote about, as you know, about family violence The story was dramatic, but it was also, I think, I hope, caused people to think, both as people who have been victims of family violence, both as people who know people have been victimized, even as people who are inclined to be victimizers, to think.
Yes.
To think what they're doing to another human being, to think what they're doing themselves, to think what they're doing to children and witnesses. I mean, those are very important things. They're not just important fictional subjects, but they're also just important human subjects. And I think they actually deepen and make fiction more important and more gripping than merely telling a story.
I have to agree with you on that point. I really do. Again, I'm going to bring up our conversation from before we went live, and I have, you know, I've been in a situation where I've been very fortunate to be able to speak to a very large audience and a lot of different audiences, and you know, have a pretty good command of statistics and things like that, simply because I try to stay on top of it. But I've actually had people say to me, you know, I don't know any men who are abusers, because we use what is the norm. And this is not to say that men aren't victimized, or gays, the gay community is not victimized. It absolutely is, and it's horrible. It's horrible for anyone. But, you know, as a generalization, I talk about women being victims of personal, interpersonal violence. And I've had guys say to me, I don't know anyone who is abusive to their wife. And I want to think, well, if one in every four women has been abused, that means this one in every four men is doing the abusing. So how can you not? And then what do? So I appreciate your books because you address some of those things. In, even though it's fiction, you still address. You address a lot of issues about women. And you've won a lot of awards, too. I mean, you won an Edgar, you know, and you've gotten the French Grand Prix. And, you know, you've gotten awards from all these wonderful agencies, the Maggie from Planned Parenthood, and people know you. And I'm so impressed by all that, and I'm so grateful that you have used social justice in your platform as a fiction writer, too.
Well, one of the things that, you know, it's interesting you should say, that men say they don't know anyone who abuses women. How do they know? I mean, because people come to work and brag that they beat the hell of their wife last night? Or that women come and say they're abused? And very often women are abused in ways that, I mean, that don't leave a mark you can see.
Well, and the emotional part is harder to get over anyway.
Exactly so. I mean, there are lots of real tragedies that are not talked about or known because the people portraying them, either the victimizers or the victims, don't talk about it because there's all this shame and fear.
Absolutely.
Either fear of the abuser or fear, if you're the abuser, of being discovered. So, you know, I mean, family violence.
Entitlement is a big motivator, and retribution is a big silencer. I will say that. So, do you think you'll write again fiction, or have you really closed down your laptop for good, Rick?
I'm now writing a weekly column for the Boston Globe, which is run in the Huffington Post. So I'm very busy with writing political commentary and all the things we've talked about, and many other things. And that's my third career. My first was as a lawyer. My second was as a novelist. I was grateful to write bestsellers. I mean, it's given me a wonderful life in terms of being able to write about things I care about and have fascinating experiences. And now I'm writing nonfiction. I've got Fever Swamp out, which I'm very proud of, and it's, I'm thankful for the good reviews. And now I'm writing a column, so I'm doing lots of writing. It's just writing about the immediate, the here and now, and sort of where we go going forward.
Interesting. Well, I tell you have a fan in me. I hope one day you'll say, Okay, maybe I'll just do one more fiction book, one more. Maybe, you know, after, maybe when things, the tide changes and things get better and you'll feel up for it. I hope that you do because you're a spectacular novelist and it's very enjoyable to read your books. I'm so happy that you came on tonight. You've given me so many things to think about, Rick, and I cannot thank you enough. I hope one day you'll come back. And tell me what you're writing about next in your columns with HuffPo through the Boston paper. Will you come back again sometime?
Oh yeah, I'd be delighted. Meanwhile, I so admire what you've done, taking personal experience in helping people through what you know. At first hand.
Oh,
I think it's
thank
a great
you.
Thing
well, you know, here's the thing. You know, I joke about it a lot, but I say, you know, well, the fool didn't cut out my tongue, so I'm going to talk about it. But in all seriousness, there are those who have had horrible experiences and somehow gather that intestinal fortitude and strength from wherever, and they move on with their lives in a very quiet, dignified way. And I honor that as, you know, like no one's business. But by the same token, there are big mouths like me who say, and you have to have a big mouth. I'm sorry. You have to have a big mouth who's willing to say, this is my crime scene photo, this is what happened, and this is why it happened. And, you know, and be willing to say, when someone asks you, well, what did you do to get him so pissed off, to be able to answer that without smacking him in the nose. And so, you know, that's my gift, I think. And
I was very
blessed to have.
The world's a better place for it.
Oh, thank you. Well, someone has to talk about it. Just the way that you're talking with Fever Swamp, A Journey Through the Strange Neverland of the 2016 presidential race. You know, it's just a great book. I hope everybody goes out and get this because it's really a fun book to read. A lot of information in there. Listen, we're going to admit it's a partisan book. There's no doubt. But there are some come-to-Jesus moments for Democrats to pay attention to also. You know, you're not so blind that you cannot see, correct?
No, I pointed those out, I hope.
Yes, you did. Richard North Patterson, I think you're wonderful. Thank you so much
for
being with me tonight.
Thank you, Pam. Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks. Good night, Rick.
Take care. Good night.
And that's our show for tonight, everyone. You got to go get Fever Swamp. It is really a fun book. You know, give it a try. Try it on for size. And if not, Richard North Patterson has a ton of delicious, wonderful, fabulous fiction. I'll be back again next week. I think I'm back on Monday with the delightful, the lovely Lisa Alber. I can't wait for her. Have a great weekend, everyone. Thanks for listening, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.